Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Jill Robbins and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, an increasing number of Venezuelans have moved out of the country recently. They are seeking to escape economic hardship and high crime rates in their homeland. Many of those Venezuelans are migrating to Brazil. One of them is Victor Rivera, a 36-year-old unemployed bakery worker. In August, Rivera left his home in northern Venezuela. He made the 2-day trip across the countryside to Boa Vista, a city in the Brazilian state of Roraima. Few jobs can be found in Boa Vista, but Rivera finds his job prospects there more appealing than in his hometown. He says his 6 children often go hungry as food in stores is in increasingly short supply. "I see no future in Venezuela," said Rivera. The once wealthy nation is now struggling with a recession, widespread unemployment, shortages of supplies, and high inflation. And at least 125 people died this year in clashes among government opponents, supporters, and police. As conditions there worsen, nearby countries are struggling with one of the biggest migrations in Latin American history. With limited public services and jobs to offer migrants, Brazilian officials fear a full humanitarian crisis. George Okoth Obo is operations chief for the United Nations High Commission on Refugees. He spoke to the Reuters news agency after a recent visit to Boa Vista. He noted, "Shelters are already crowded to their limit. It is a very tough situation." Venezuelan government officials do not know exactly how many of its 30 million people have migrated overseas in recent years. Some experts have estimated the number to be as high as 2 million. Many of the Venezuelans leaving have few skills or financial resources. By migrating, then, they export some of the social problems that Venezuela has struggled to resolve. Mauricio Santoro is a political scientist at Rio de Janeiro State University. He says, "They are leaving because of economic, health, and public safety problems, but putting a lot of pressure on countries that have their own difficulties." International officials are likening the situation in Venezuela to other mass migrations in Latin America's past, like that of people who fled Haiti after a 2010 earthquake. 30 years earlier, about 125,000 Cubans attempted to travel by boat to the United States. Okoth Obo told Reuters that as many as 40,000 Venezuelans have arrived in Brazil. Just over half of them have asked the government for asylum. But that process can take up to 2 years. The request for asylum gives them the right to stay in Brazil while their appeal is considered. It also gives the migrants the right to health care, education, and other social services. Some migrants in Boa Vista are discovering ways to get by. They have found low-cost housing or are staying in the few shelters that officials have provided. Others have no permanent place to stay and instead live in the streets or turn to crime. Teresa Zurita, the mayor of Boa Vista, said, "We have a very serious problem that will only get worse." She added that the city's once quiet streets are increasingly filled with poor Venezuelans. Most migrants to Boa Vista arrive by land. They enter Brazil on foot from the Venezuelan border town of Santa Elena. They then take buses or ask for rides from strangers to travel further south. Latin America's biggest country has struggled recently to deal with asylum seekers from countries such as Haiti and Syria. Brazil has approved more than 2,700 asylum requests from Syrian refugees. But the refugees have received little support from the government. One top official in Brazil's foreign ministry said the country will not close its borders. Okoth Obo said the UNHCR and Brazil's government are discussing ways to move refugees to larger cities.
In the film Caddyshack, American actor Bill Murray plays a golf caddy. He carries golf clubs for other people and offers them advice on how to play the sport. At one point in the film, Murray tells an outrageous story. He claims to have traveled to the Himalayas and helped the Dalai Lama play golf. After one game, Murray says he asked the Tibetan spiritual leader for money. Here are a few lines from the movie.
So we finish 18, and he's going to stiff me. And I say, "Hey, Lama, hey, how about a little something, you know, for the effort, you know?" And he says, "Oh, there won't be any money. But when you die, on your deathbed, you will receive total consciousness."
Today, we will not explore the world of golf. Instead, we will consider the meaning of two words, you know. You heard them used twice in our example. We will show you how and why Americans use this expression. You might be surprised to learn how you know has many uses.
If you listen to Americans as they speak, you will often hear them say, you know, in strange places in a sentence. You might hear it at the beginning, middle, or end of a sentence. When Americans say, you know, they might mean it in a literal sense, as in the following.
Do you know that person?
Yes, I know him.
However, today we are talking about how English speakers use you know in other ways. These include social uses, such as saying you know to soften the meaning of a statement. Language experts have a term for such an expression, an acknowledgement marker. You do not need to worry about the term now. Just remember that English speakers choose some words for social uses. They mean more than the individual words suggest. Do not fear. We will clarify these points by giving you examples from popular culture.
You know gives other people the idea that you have some kind of shared knowledge with them. People use it to show that they have a common understanding. Sometimes people use an acknowledgement marker because they want to know if you agree with them. Other times, they use it as a way to fill spaces in a conversation or discussion. Saying, "you know," gives the speaker time to think of what to say next. The context tells you which of these purposes "you know" serves.
Let's study an example. Think back to the line from Caddyshack.
And I say, "hey, Lama, hey, how about a little something, you know, for the effort, you know."
Here, Murray is asking for a tip, a small payment. When Murray says "you know" before and after the words "for the effort," he is suggesting that the Dalai Lama knows he has worked hard. Murray uses "you know" to offer a suggestion. He does not want to ask for money directly. He wants to improve his chances of getting the tip by using indirect language. Murray's caddy could have simply said, "can you give me a tip for helping you?" Such a direct question would be considered disrespectful in American culture.
Let's look at another example. Consider this exchange from the 1994 film Leon the Professional.
"My parents died in a car accident 4 weeks ago. It was terrible."
"You know, we didn't have the time to get to know one another when you first came here, but I want you to know that I'm not the kind of woman who'd let down a child, whatever her situation, whatever her mistake."
Here, the second speaker begins her sentence with "you know." In this situation, she wants to gain the trust of the young girl. She begins her sentence with "you know" so that it gives the girl the idea that they have a connection. She wants to give her new information, but she also wants to make her words sound familiar. She also wants to improve her chances of a positive response from the young girl.
Here is one final example. Imagine two people are staying late at work. One person might tell another person they need to go. She might say,
"Hey, Jane, you know the last train leaves in 15 minutes.
Here, the speaker is presenting information about the train, as if it is known information. Jane probably does not know that the train is leaving soon. But her coworker wants to soften the statement by using language that suggests she does know that the train is leaving.
The term "you know" is not a new form of slang. "You know" has a long history, according to John McWhorter, a language expert. He says that English speakers have long used words and expressions such as "you know." McWhorter points to lines in Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales as an example. Chaucer wrote the now famous work in the 14th century. In The Knight's Tale, the character Emily says the words "thou woost." The word "thou" later became "you" as the English language changed over time. "Woost" is the verb that eventually became "know." McWhorter notes that "thou woost" was the 14th century version of the modern day "you know."
The next time you are listening to an English speaker, try to find examples of "you know." How often does the person use those words? Why do you think they are using them? You should be careful about using "you know." Sometimes English learners become nervous and use "you know" too often. This overuse of "you know" means that they do not practice using other expressions or vocabulary. The point of today's story was to show you how English speakers use certain words and expressions for social uses. There are many others, which we can explore in another Everyday Grammar program.
You know, I think we should end our report now.
Okay, I think you are right. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm John Russell. ¶¶
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we begin the story of Alexander Hamilton. He was one of the country's founding fathers. He never became president. He did, however, become the country's first Secretary of the Treasury. At that time, the American government was very weak. It had many debts and no money. Many of the country's citizens did not support their own government. Many wondered if America would last. In a few years, however, there was a change. This change was produced in large part by the energy and imagination of one man, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton wanted to make America a strong and important nation. He wanted it to become the equal of the powerful nations of Europe. There is much mystery about the early days of Alexander Hamilton. Some facts about his childhood and youth have been clearly established. Others have not. Historians think he was born around 1755 or 1757. His mother was the daughter of French Huguenots who had settled in the British West Indies. Her name was Rachel Lavien. Historians are not sure who his father was. One story says he may have been James Hamilton, a poor businessman from Scotland. Rachel Lavien lived with him after she left her husband. One thing is certain. His mother died when he was 11 years old. When she died, friends of the family found work for the boy on the island of St. Croix, then called Santa Cruz, in the Virgin Islands. He became an assistant bookkeeper and learned how to keep financial records. Young Alexander was not like the other children. Other children played games. He talked about becoming a political leader in the North American colonies. He read every book that was given to him in English, French, Latin, and Greek. At a young age, he learned a great deal about business and economics, and he developed an ability to communicate ideas clearly and powerfully.
He showed great talents as a writer, very observant, and gained notice when he wrote an account of a local hurricane, which was picked up by the local press.
Valerie Paley is a historian at the New York Historical Society. She says Hamilton's writing was so good that his boss and some other people decided to help him get a good education. They gave him money so he could attend a college in New York City. The boy's plan was to study medicine and return to St. Croix as a doctor. But he never lived in the West Indies again. At King's College in New York City, both teachers and students were surprised by Hamilton's intelligence and clear way of communicating. He often expressed his thinking about the problems of the American colonies. Hamilton was against British rule. He wrote a paper defending the colonists in the city of Boston who seized a British ship and threw its cargo of tea into the water. The protest over taxes became known as the Boston Tea Party. Valerie Paley of the New York Historical Society says Hamilton's upbringing may have influenced his views.
Some historians have argued that he was somewhat stateless. He was adrift. He was his own man. And in a way, there was something so passionately right for Hamilton in joining something as apparently important as a revolutionary cause.
The year 1776 arrived. The 13 American colonies declared their independence from Britain. The declaration meant war. The American Revolution gave Hamilton the chance to show his abilities. He became part of a New York militia and fought in some important early battles. It was not long before Hamilton met the commander-in-chief of American forces, George Washington. General Washington recognized Hamilton's talents. He promoted Hamilton and invited him to become an aide. In that job, Hamilton wrote letters and reports for Washington. Hamilton had to use all his political and communication skills to get money and supplies for the Revolutionary Army. He asked the 13 state governments. He also asked the Congress, which had little political power at that time. He got almost no help from either. Hamilton came to believe firmly that the American system of government was too weak and disorganized. Even so, historian Valerie Paley says Hamilton became one of the most important people on George Washington's staff.
Hamilton had never had a father, of course, that he knew or knew well, so there was something very, very loyal and very, very trusting about the relationship between the men. So I think it was something that was extremely important and influential to Hamilton's growth as a politician and as a thinker.
She says their relationship was almost like a father and son. But that did not mean their relationship was always good. Alexander Hamilton was a proud man. He was quick to criticize others. He even criticized George Washington. Once, during the war, Hamilton was late to a meeting with the general. Washington protested. Hamilton resigned. For the next 8 years, Hamilton was very busy. He led troops in some of the last battles of the American Revolution. He became a lawyer. He founded the Bank of New York, one of the very first banks in the country. He helped save his old school, King's College, and turn it into what is now Columbia University. He was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. He wrote some of the Federalist Papers, among the most famous documents in American history. Hamilton's defense of a strong central government persuaded many Americans to ratify the Constitution and establish a new system of government. Historian Valerie Paley says Hamilton had a visionary way of thinking about the world.
He thought up, some would argue, the whole notion of what modern America is in terms of the way government works, in terms of finance, banking. He saw the importance of certain structures we take for granted before they even existed.
All Hamilton needed was a way to make his ideas happen. George Washington gave Hamilton that power. When Washington became president, he forgot their disagreement during the war. He asked his former aide to become the country's first Secretary of the Treasury. The job would be difficult.
The United States at that time was a financial basket case.
Business historian John Steele Gordon wrote a book about Hamilton.
There was no real money supply. In the colonial days, they had used a hodgepodge of coins from British and Spanish and Portuguese and what have you. It's a very chaotic system.
In other words, there was no such thing yet as American money. John Steele Gordon says America also had to borrow heavily to pay for the Revolutionary War. The new nation was deeply in debt. It had to find ways to bring in money and pay what it owed. One way to get money was to borrow it. But no one wanted to lend money to the United States unless they were sure they would get it back. So the Congress asked Treasury Secretary Hamilton to write a report about how to build up the government's credit. Hamilton's report said the government must pay back the full amount of all its debts. This caused a dispute. Many of the debts were in the form of government notes. The notes promised to pay someone for supplying food, clothing, and weapons to the rebel army. Some promised to pay soldiers for joining the army. The notes, however, were really worth nothing. The wartime Congress had no money. People who got them lost hope of ever getting repaid. So they sold them to anyone willing to pay even part of the value. Hamilton's plan would repay the full value of the notes to those who owned them last. Hamilton believed that those who bought the notes had a right to earn money from them. He said these men took a chance that the worthless notes would be worth something someday. Congressman James Madison of Virginia protested. He said the people who bought the notes at low cost should be paid, but not in full. Some of the money, he said, should go to those who got the notes in exchange for supplies or services. Madison made an emotional speech in Congress. He described the situation of former soldiers forced by hunger to sell their government notes for almost nothing. He noted that the Union was established to protect the people against such injustice. Hamilton answered that the purpose of his plan was greater than simply paying debts. He said it was a way to build up the nation's credit so it could borrow money more easily in the future. Many members of Congress felt sorry for the poor soldiers and their families. Yet, they voted against Madison's proposal and supported Hamilton's plan. Still, to win support for his plan, Hamilton had to make a political deal with several congressmen. They would support his financial plan, but he had to use his influence to get the capital of the United States moved. At that time, the Capitol was in the north, in New York City. Two congressmen from Virginia wanted it in the south, near their homes along the Potomac River. Several congressmen from Pennsylvania agreed, but they said the Capitol must first be moved to the city of Philadelphia in their state, and it must remain there for 10 years. Congress accepted this plan by a close vote. President Washington signed it into law. Hamilton was still a young man in his 30s, but he had already succeeded in remaking the country's economic policies, and he had established the country's permanent capital in Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia. He had also made some enemies. His next plan would create even more.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.